Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Stephen Dozman. How are we to conceive of acts that suddenly expose the injustice of the current order? This is a question that has puzzled philosophers for centuries, and it's the question of my guest today, Dominik Finkeld, and he is here to discuss it with his book, Excessive Subjectivity, Kant, Hegel, Lacan, and the Foundation of Ethics, from Columbia University Press in 2017. The book looks at these three major thinkers in the ways they saw subjects as being immersed in a particular set of ethical orientations, but also always with a subtle but profound potential to do something beyond what they might have thought possible. Dominik Finkeld is a professor of contemporary political philosophy and epistemology at the Munich School of Philosophy, and is also the author of Zizek Between Lacan and Hegel and Benjamin Reed's Proust. So, Dominik Finkeld, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks for having me.
So we always like to kind of have our guests introduce themselves. So could you maybe tell us a bit about who you are and what your main research interests tend to be?
Well, as you said, I teach here in Munich at the Munich School of Philosophy and in the areas of epistemology and contemporary philosophy, especially contemporary political philosophy. I grew up in Berlin and also studied there philosophy and critical theory or comparative literature at the university. Then I wrote my PhD in Munich on the topic that you mentioned, Benjamin. It was a topic on the philosophy of language of Benjamin, and I was analyzing the way Marcel Proust had an impact on Benjamin. And then I wrote my habilitation. So the second big book, I also published smaller books, the one you mentioned on Zizek, also a little book on the debate on Paul the Apostle and political philosophy. But for me, the most important book in the last years was Excessive Subjectivity. And I published this several years ago. And since 4 or 5 years, I'm here professor at the Munich Faculty of Philosophy.
Wonderful. So to kick things off, in the beginning of the book, you point to a contradiction in Kant's life, where on the one hand, he expressed some admiration for those in the French Revolution, but at the same time argued that revolutionaries ought to be universally condemned. You jump off of this to discuss the gap between the thinker's freedom and the subject's duty. Can you speak to this tension a bit and how it sets up your own project here?
Well, thanks for the question, because it goes right into the topic of the book. I think everybody in the academic community knows that Kant is not a philosopher who favors revolutions. He is seen as the philosopher of duty to the moral law, but also to the state. So, in front of this background, it is rather surprising that Kant, in a famous text, The Conflict of the Faculties, expresses somehow respect and esteem for the revolution, French Revolution, since he says that seen from afar, from Germany to France, it can provoke esteem, because we have the impression there's really a progress of normativity to be contemplated. But this esteem for the revolution stands somehow in contrast to what he writes in the Metaphysics of Morals, that revolutionaries must be universally condemned by the law. And this is truly surprising. How can you combine these two different perspectives? How can you look from distance with enthusiasm to a revolution, but immediately, so when you zoom into the revolution, then you see people's or revolutionaries that have, polemically speaking, have to be sent to the gallows. So it appears as if Kant wants a revolution without revolutionaries. And what I like in this paradox is Kant's own struggle with normativity, because when he defends the moral law as an absolute call that must be obeyed, even when the consequences are horrible for the individual, but also for other, this is one part of his moral philosophy. But then we have this other part that he defends the political status quo by all means. And I think this paradox is, for me, the starting point. How can Kant have both opinions? So somehow focus on what I would call excessive subjectivity, somehow the bizarre art of an individual or a group to declare a subjective state of emergency, because I think this is somehow also in as a part of Kant's concept of the moral law. But as I said, it stands in contrast to his defense of the status quo and the defense of the state by all means. To make this point once more clear, because even when Kant wants to send the revolutionaries to the gallows, he himself presents us in his philosophy with a moral will that is so radical that, for example, Hegel, in a very famous quote, says that the Kantian concept of the moral conscience is co-responsible for the French Revolution. And I think this is a little bit the key argument of my first chapter on Kant, this paradox when Hegel himself says, well, Kant's moral philosophy is so radical, we have to take it into account. It is somehow the centerpiece of the radical of the radicality of the French Revolution. But on the other hand, we don't see Kant as the one who really can give a theory for this. And this is a little bit the starting point to get into Kant and to give an answer to this paradox. How can we have this radical Kant on the one hand and this somehow blind defender of the status quo of the state?
Yeah, it sets up a really interesting tension. Turning briefly to Hegel, you discuss what you call the paradox of autonomy, a problem Hegel received from both Kant and Rousseau. Can you explain the paradox here?
Well, the paradox of autonomy refers back, to a paradox that we all know. For example, the paradox how to educate children, our children, so that they can be free and self-determining citizens or human beings. Though exactly this education in being free has to be organized and done by others. So this is, I think, maybe the basic argument of the paradox of autonomy. How can you be trained by others to be free, a free agent, and a free agent of your deeds and especially of moral acts? Or said differently, how can you be part of society where society somehow throws you under the bus of what's the established status of normativity, but at the same time, society wants you to accept this normativity that you are thrown under the bus of and accept so freely. Remember that Rousseau, and this is where this paradox somehow comes from, that Rousseau sees in modern society, as a radically speaking, or a little bit cliche-like speaking, pure evil, and he imagines, therefore, in his novel Emile or on education, how we have to educate the next generation so that they are not continuing the corruption that Rousseau sees in his surrounding. Then, and again, you see the paradox. So, how can we educate people so that they change society, but we have to educate them from within society? And then you could say we have the German Enlightenment authors like Lessing or Schiller or Herder. They try to circumvent this paradox when they say, well, of course, yeah, we have to educate them in aesthetics, for example. Then aesthetics becomes the big the big theoretical field of research, because the Germans would like to evade the French Revolution, but nevertheless see also the need for the education of mankind, so that a revolution, French Revolution, does not repeat itself. And I would say that Kant sticks somehow to this paradox, also because he maintains, and this is also very central to his moral philosophy, that morality cannot be trained. We can educate people, but morality is beyond education. This does not exclude education, of course. Education is also for Kant a very necessary condition of morality, but it is not a sufficient condition. So morality is for Kant somehow a category of exception of excess of too muchness. And this is also, of course, for my argument, very important. Excuse me. Now Hegel comes
along. Yeah, you're fine.
I wanted to continue, but
sorry, I thought you were
can
done.
I?
Yeah, go ahead. Yep.
Well, now we have Hegel who comes along, and Hegel criticizes Kant's radicality on the one hand. He also says, Kant is a little bit too formalistic in his understanding. We need, of course, society. We need the context of society so that, human beings can have inclinations, that they have a feeling for the moral law. It doesn't have to be abstract. But on the other hand, Hegel also says, this is brilliant what Kant presents us to. Well, this is beautiful because it's the radicality of Kant that Hegel on the other side accepts as so important. So this also very important to see how Hegel has a take on Kant. So he criticizes some of the formality, but he says, nevertheless, with Kant we have a new kind of subjectivity that is so radical somehow as Descartes' cogito is radical, because it's the subjectivity that has a new understanding of what conscience is about. And this also makes us clear when Hegel makes this reference that the principle of Kant's moral law is somehow the principle of the French Revolution. It's for Hegel, really something absolutely radically new. Kantian ethics has nothing to do with Aristotelian concept of the good life. It has nothing to do with pragmatics. It has nothing to do with utilitarianism. It has much to do with individuality and with the call of the moral law. But the source of this call is somehow the subject herself. I think that's about the idea.
Yeah, so to turn to the first main chapter in the book, which focuses on Kant more thoroughly, one key term that comes up throughout the chapter is disposition, or more specifically, the revolution of disposition. So to start things off here, can you unpack the function Kant sees disposition playing in his theory of the subject and how it will feed into his ethical theory?
Yeah, of course. I try to make a long story short. My thesis is that Kant presents us in his ethics with a kind of theory of split subjectivity, and this brings me, of course, then later in the book to my third chapter on Kant and Lacan. What do I mean with that? I mean that for Kant there is somehow a divine-like or even devilish-like force in the individual subject that is responsible for our moral acts, and this force, and this evil force or holy force, cannot be put under control, even not under control by reason itself. And this sounds, of course, very strange, since many academic communities working on Kant would say in general, that Kant's ethical agency is all about reason, and reason is universal. So why am I focused on this force that is somehow super reasonable or beyond reason? And I do so with reference to what Kant calls, as you said, or as you mentioned, the disposition, or what he calls the revolution of disposition. He also calls it sometimes a change of heart. These are all figures of thought for him, but I think Kant uses them to express that for him in moral acts, the human being is overcome by what he calls, also in another place, in the horrible voice of the moral law. And so what I'm interested in is how he describes, in what kind of metaphors he describes the moral law, and that he says, well, the moral law cannot be betrayed, but it is somehow something alien in us, in the subject, that even the subject cannot really truly dominate, and not dominate even by reason. So the source of this voice cannot be positivistically be determined. But if so, then also the moral law cannot, of course, itself not be determined. But if morality cannot be trained, and this is also, as I said, a key aspect of Kant's moral philosophy, then we are somehow back to the paradox of autonomy. Well, and because you could ask, well, who speaks? Who is the author? Who is the voice of the moral law? What is it? Yeah, where's the final source of the subject? From which this voice is coming. And I would say, well, in Kant's perspective, it's the moral law itself that calls upon the subject. But it comes from the inner split of subjectivity itself. And this is, I think, what his concept of the revolution of disposition stands for. In that sense, this is, I think, the point where the split subject comes in, because the revolution of disposition doesn't explain anything. It just explains, well, there is something beyond in me that can overcome me, and maybe then we have moral acts. It's also interesting that Kant says that we can never be sure that we have done any moral act in our entire lifetime, because, of course, we have never an insight into the motivation of our moral acts. But nevertheless, so the what he calls the disposition is somehow for me the entrance to develop in a theory of split subjectivity.
Another key theme that runs throughout this chapter is temporality and the way certain ethical or maybe supra-ethical acts function to disrupt a certain chain of events, both shuffling our past as well as our disposition towards our present. So can you unpack what Kant is getting at here regarding time and temporality's relationship to ethical acts?
Well, as I said, the ethical act of agency can disrupt somehow ethics as the discipline that normally conforms to the universal law. I mean, ethics is normally defined as the research into the establishment of values. And for example, in discourse ethics, we have this kind of we find our values via the debate between free moral agents. And in general, this is what we would call that ethics is about. But as I said, I'm more fascinated with this Kant who somehow crisscrosses ethics from his concept of an excessive subject of moral agency. And this is of course a subject that you never see somehow in the big Kantian literature on Kant. For example, you have discourse ethics who integrate Kant as the moral author of reasonable debate. Or you have, this would be the Kant of Habermas or Apel, discourse ethics. And then you have, for example, Kant as the big author of the autonomy of the reasonable subject, interpreted by Christine Korsgaard, who links somehow Kant's concept of reason and morality back and autonomy back to antique philosophers. And you have, for example, Brandom and McDowell as philosopher who see Kant as some kind of pragmatic philosopher. But what I'm interested is in that what these schools see is that in the heart of Kantian ethics, you have not only ethics, but you have the ethical agency. You have what I call the ethical. And this overtaxes the political reality, or it overtaxes situations. And maybe I can give a short example of what I mean with these kind of ethical agency. Because
sure,
take for example political subjects we know from the last years, like Julian Assange or Edward Snowden. I mean, we all know what their agency was like. And I think when we focus on these excessive subject, we see somehow immediately also again the paradox of autonomy that we were talking about. Because with regard to these authors, we have to ask us if the deeds that they were known for, you remember leaking classified information to the public, if these acts were morally good or morally reprehensible. And one could say, well, on the one hand, we have Kant, the defender of the state, who would say, well, send them to the gallows. I mean, treason is never an answer. But then you have Kant, the defender also of the moral law, who might say it's up to the voice of the moral law and as such up to the individual if this individual wants to grant this voice a hearing. And what's interesting, so it's difficult to say, well, what can discourse ethics give an answer here? I would say it cannot. Can pragmatics give an answer here? Neither. Because you have these irresponsible subjects who somehow crisscross the standards of what is valuable or what is normatively acceptable from the perspective of the state. And also, as I said, for Kant, the perspective of the state is absolutely essential, because he would say we cannot start the state from scratch. But nevertheless, in Kant's moral philosophy, he gives the individual the basic source of even putting into question the entire world, though not on a practical level for the establishment of the state, but on a theoretical level when he focuses on what is morality all about, or moral agency. And we see in these cases that I just mentioned, Assange and Edward Snowden, that there is no yes or no answer to the morality of their acts, because you always have good arguments for these acts. I mean, who would deny that these acts were morally very good? But I would say every argument is confronted with a counter argument. That I could imagine that if you have Edward Snowden arguing with his girlfriend, should he do this or not? Should he risk his personal career for this debate? I think there will not be a final answer. It comes to the subject, himself or herself, then really to act out what it perceives as the moral law, even if the subject himself or herself doesn't have a final argument for it. And I think this is quite an amazing description of what the call of the moral law may be like. It might be a law, it might be a call that you even do not really hear clearly, or it's only an emotion, or it's only an acting out. And this is essential. And this is essential when we talk about Kant's formal description of the moral agency. So that it is somehow monolithic and not dialogical. So the subject in these situations might be thrown back on herself or himself as the only source to say, well, I have to take the risk because the future might give me the reasons. The future might give me the reasons, but I have to bet my excessive subjectivity onto this future. And I think this is what the ethical stands for in comparison to what ethics is about. Ethics is about discussion, preconditions of discussions, give many people the chance to debate what they want. But the ethical is looking of what the preconditions of the debate leave out, that there are always preconditions. And this is, so in that sense, the ethical crisscrosses ethics. And I think one can make Kant responsible for this radicality.
To close things off with Kant, the subtitle of this chapter is The Split Subject of Ethical Agency, which comes up in the form of a certain tension you refer to throughout the chapter. You read at one point, quote, Kant was truly aware of the radicality of his position and very consciously wanted to leave a possibly insurmountable tension between the spheres of right virtue and the moral for the sake of the impossibility of integrating the ethical into ethics. So to close things off here with Kant, can you explain this tension he has in his ethical theory between the ethical and ethics, and how this tension should actually be seen as a feature rather than a bug.
Okay. Well, this refers to what I said just some minutes ago, but maybe the following example helps. Think of a judge in court appointed by the public. I mean, in a way, the power of a judge is, as we know, to incarnate somehow an excess of law that is part of law itself, because compared to an always limited number of paragraphs, we know that life situations have an unlimited number. So we only have a certain number of laws, and the certain number of laws is confronted with the flow of life that is unlimited. This is why we have judges, because we would say the authority of law cannot be done or enacted by computers or machines, because we need to understand the flow of context and then apply the algorithm of a law to certain situations. But nevertheless, it is so in that sense, the judge's decision to cut into the law or into the flesh of the culprit and into the tradition, because finally we need some kind of jurisdiction. And this is, of course, for our society, no problem. Every juridical system functions like that. So we grant the judge an excess of power because compared to a limited number of laws, we have an unlimited number of situations. Now, to repeat my point, I think Kant's radicality is this, that he grants this authority to the individual subject confronted with the moral law. And in a way, it's the formality of Kant's imperative or his categorical imperative that is of importance, because it is exactly that, because Kant says, well, let's not so much look on the context, but let's look on the formality of the maxims that we are trying to get to. So again, we see the difference to Habermasian project of discourse ethics, because there's always the talk about the recognition of free responsible agents. But the ethical is, as I said, with the example of the judge, it crisscrosses the limited standards of what is perceived as what ethics is about. The ethical somehow is a surplus power of ethics, and in that sense has the ability to question what ethics seems or of what ethics defends as what is most valuable and most universal to ethics. And in that sense, it can be truly devilish, not even what Kant calls radical evil. It can be devilish evil. It can counter every intuition we have of morality. And I think this is what Kant refers to.
Next, you turn to Hegel, who, fairly or not, has often been accused of having a sort of totalizing and in some cases totalitarian worldview. But you come out against this view. Early in your chapter on him, you bring up his critique of Kantian formalism, although it's not just that he thinks Kant is wrong, but fails to develop his theory fully. So can you unpack Hegel's critical development here?
Well, one can say, with regard to the case of totalitarian world, one can say that, well, Hegel has at least two concepts of Geist, of what he called spirit. Geist is for him, on the one hand, let's say the sum totals of our norms, of rituals, societies, the codex juris that a society has. This is one form of what the spirit is for Hegel all about. But then he also talks about world spirit, or no, not only world spirit, he talks about spirit as the sum total of what the history of knowledge is all about. And you all often you have this cliché that Hegel somehow is a pre-Kantian philosopher because he has this concept of Geist as if Geist would be some kind of godlike entity. Also, imagine, we can think of this kind of Weltgeist as take the movie The Truman Show, where the director of The Truman Show lives above the props of reality and in some kind of netherworld. And sometimes one has the impression that there is this stereotype of Hegel who thinks Geist or spirit as this entity beyond the realm of phenomena. But what I'm interested in, what is absolutely important, is that Hegel says, well, what he calls spirit is always in the process of its becoming. And so there's never the end point of spirit like God that pulls spirit into the potentiality of its being. But it's rather that spirit itself understands itself retrospectively through all the horrible history that spirit has left behind in mankind. But important is that important is that what spirit is spirit only retrospectively from the position of that it is right now, for example, right now in the 21st century. And for Hegel, what is important in this case is that he needs these kinds of subjects that he is fascinated or that he presents in the phenomenology of spirit, because there we have these subjects that somehow incorporate what he calls the Kantian moral, the Kantian morality, or what he understands as conscience, because he says that while Kant speaks of the split subjectivity, or that's the way I interpret it in his moral philosophy, Hegel somehow takes the split subject of moral agency and transforms it into the motor, into the engine of what for him ethical life is about. So. And in that sense, what Hegel understands as spirit is always the spirit being confronted with moral agents, and these moral agents bring spirit in its normative framework on the brink of collapse. And that's the way for Hegel that spirit progresses through the centuries. So in that sense, spirit is not. Can never be absolute in that sense that it already knows what's coming. Spirit somehow is confronted through excessive subjects with what it could not have even imagined. And this is fascinating, because now you have somehow this idea of Hegel as a materialist. It's not that Hegel, when he talks about, and this also, of course, an interpretation that is very much that I owe very much to Slavoj Žižek and the Lacanian Hegelian school, the Lacanian school, who really focus on the materialistic dimension of what Hegel calls spirit. So spirit is experiences in world history, and spirit doesn't know what will be next. But this is what Hegel focuses on. So that's why we have forms of negativity. That's why spirit is always confronted with its own non-being. And I would say that excessive subjects are the motor in this. And in that sense, he takes the Kantian split subject of moral agency and transforms it into what for him ethical life is about. Ethical life is about spirit, but through excessive subjectivity, it's ethical life, which confronted with ethical life cannot yet understand, but only retrospectively when, let's say, these excessive subjects have entered the future, and from that perspective on, give us the chance to see truly what has been missing in the past. Right now, for example, in the 21st century, we don't see what's missing, because we are always interested in maintaining the status quo. But there's always, of course, too much antagonism that we don't see, and in that sense, for Hegel, spirit is always the struggle of its non-identity. It's always the struggle with the contingency of history. And so it's spirit is not the guarantee of being, or the guarantee that the basic structure of reality is coherent, but it's rather that the basic structure of reality is, though it is normative and it's conceptual and it's all what we can understand, but nevertheless, there's always a missing link. There's always a lack, and excessive subjects can come through this lack and be of importance, and then show spirit and Geist that it hasn't understood yet its own potential.
Yeah, kind of developing off what you've been talking about, one of Hegel's most famous ethical examinations comes in the form of his study of the story of Antigone. You write, quote, What characterizes Antigone is precisely that through her, a detail emerges, which, as part of the ethical substance, brings this substance into a discrepancy with itself through a sacrilegious deed. So can you unpack the Hegelian deed in Antigone's story and how it brings to light a tension between the individual subject and the polis?
Yeah. Well, as I said, my chapter on Hegel is called the split ethical life and the subject. And my first chapter was called Kant's split subject of ethical agency. And as I said, I think Hegel takes Kant's radicality and uses it for his phenomenology. And in that sense, we come now to Antigone, because Antigone stands for this somehow split subjectivity or radical agency that is of so much importance for Hegel in the phenomenology. Because when Antigone wants to, we know the story, she wants to borrow her brother Polyneikes, who fought against Thebes and in that sense fought against the state in Creon. We know that she brings herself in confrontation to the state. Or to say it differently, she somehow declares a state of emergency and as such brings Creon truly in danger because of course Creon cannot accept this act of defiance. And I think, again, we are very similar to excessive subjects that I just mentioned with regard to Edward Snowden or Julian Assange. We have here really subjects on the borderline between holy and being fanatics. And Hegel refers with Antigone to some kind of fanaticism. And in that sense, maybe we come to this later, that in that sense, I also try to underline in the book that these excessive subjects have to be paranoid in a way. They have to be oversensitive to what reality is about. They have to see something that the others don't see, and that makes it difficult for them to make themselves comprehensible. And this is somehow what we see in Antigone. So when Antigone, because Antigone, her case is very interesting, because Sophocles describes that when Antigone says, well, I have to obey the laws of the netherworlds, I think you say netherworlds or Netherlands.
I think underworld would be.
Yeah, the underworld, exactly, yeah, underworld. So when Antigone, Sophocles says there's an interpellation or a call by the laws of the underworld, but Sophocles also at the same time says, well, nobody knows where they come from. So that's very interesting, because you could say that Antigone refers to a tradition, but she has no knowledge of the tradition because somehow the knowledge is lost or it wasn't necessary. On the other hand, you have the modern state that I presume it's a little bit rationally. It's built on this non-describable law of the underworld or of the tradition of the family. So this is for Hegel a very fascinating case, because you could also say Antigone couldn't enter in the game of giving and asking for reasons. That's an expression that Robert Brandom uses. Or Antigone couldn't get into discourse ethics and debate her argument, because in that sense her argument is bogus. I mean, she even cannot give an explanation of the law she refers to. I mean, you could say it's feeling or it's tradition, but I mean that's no argument. But and that's so interesting. But what she has is conscience. And again, I think we are here at a category that cannot be integrated into ethics, because conscience is she has certitude, she has conviction, she doesn't need an argument. A little bit the same. I mean, totally different situations, but I would say the same with Assange or Snowden. You have these subjects. They have conviction. They can give arguments, of course. Also, Antigone could get arguments. We should respect the tradition, but these arguments have no force on the realm of giving and asking for reasons. And in that sense, we see Antigone here as this surplus power of normativity against the state. And Hegel is fascinated by this, because he says, well, she is right and she is wrong. It doesn't say, Hegel doesn't say, well, it's brilliant, Antigone, go for it. You're absolutely right. No, he says that's the drama. Creon is right and Antigone is right. It just explains how spirit in this case struggles with an inner antagonism, and it doesn't have an answer. And then we have the next stage, somehow the Roman law and the phenomenology, where some of these traditions are now absorbed and integrated. But at first, the most important thing is to realize what I would say, that Antigone somehow is paranoid. She has a sensitivity, she has a conviction, but she cannot explain it. She perceives something that the others don't see. And here again, we are, I would say, in confrontation with split subjectivity and with the antagonism between the ethical and ethics.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, you were kind of alluding to Antigone's possible mental state, and you end the chapter on Hegel with a discussion of madness and elsewhere discuss schizophrenia, although you understand it differently than we often might today. Rather than seeing it as a condition that requires institutionalization, you write of it as a phase of or a necessary step for the subject to take in order to get to a new level of subjectivity. So can you unpack this understanding of madness for us?
Yeah, thanks for the question. When I refer in the book to schizophrenia, I use the term in a certain interpretation. I mean, there are probably libraries on the topic, but I use a certain interpretation presented by Marianne Krühl in her book on the topic. And she gives a very nice interpretation. She says she defines schizophrenia as the inclusion of society's antagonism into the emotional world of the schizophrenic subject. So that's a nice description. So the schizophrenic subject somehow absorbs antagonism that is always out there in society. There is no society that is in antagonism free, though of course there are unconscious structures who by definition have to suppress these antagonisms, otherwise we would go mad. But the schizophrenic somehow absorbs these antagonisms into the emotional world. But not only that, Hull also shows that the schizophrenic lacks repression capacities. But of course, as I said, these repression capacities are absolutely necessary for our mind to diminish the confrontation with apparent contradictions that we see in everyday life. And in that sense, I would say somebody like Antigone is somehow paranoid or schizophrenic, because she sees the contradiction in the polis that is something fundamentally of importance for her. She sees the contradiction of the polis, and she cannot repress this contradiction. That's very different from her sister Ismene. Ismene can she doesn't care, but Antigone, she cares. She cares too much. And again, we are confronted with the situation: why does it happen that some people care and other people don't? Why is it that Edward Snowden cares or Julian Assange? And their colleagues who have maybe the same background, they don't. And I would say, for me, I only can say it, well, they have some kind of oversensitivity, even some kind of schizophrenic paranoia, that they that they that they that individualizes them and also isolates them. And you always can ask them, well, aren't you oversensitive? Aren't you irrational? I think, and all these arguments against them, I think, are valid. Aren't you overtaxing what you're seeing? I mean, why leak these informations when the state is so important? And especially now after the Cold War, we have new power struggles. Why do you want to confront the state with this antagonism? Why can't you let it go? But I think schizophrenia in the definition of Marianne Krull gives a good definition, at least, that these individuals take the antagonism of society as something personally on their body, and in that sense they have to act out to get rid of this antagonism, and other people don't.
Yeah, so that wraps up Hegel for us. So finally, turning to Lacan, you start off by drawing connections between politics and psychoanalysis. So if I can quote you at length to kind of bring us in here, you write, quote, "Interiority turns out to be a foreign body for Lacan, invaded by an other. It stems from a semantic field that, because it is overdetermined, always overtaxes us. This other in the own often prevents us from finding peace in our dreams and accompanies the subject throughout her life. It also concerns the political order in which the subject lives as zoon politikon, since she expects this order, among other things, to compensate for her own shortcomings. The subject is haunted by an insatiable insistence of desire to be inscribed into the political order that, for its part, renders itself impossible due to its own deficiencies." End quote. So in this passage, you've given us a summary of a lot, but I mainly wanted to read it to help introduce listeners to the overlap of metapsychology and politics, namely the way things like desire and lack overlap with politics and the polis. So to prepare the ground a bit for this final chapter, can you speak to the relationship between these two fields as you and Lacan understand them?
Yeah, of course, because as you said, these are totally essential because, of course, my goal is then to connect these rather political philosophers now with the theoretical frame of psychoanalysis. To give some introductory remarks, one could say that Lacan gives us in his philosophy some kind of an inner psychological topography of how we as subjects are interlinked with the society that surrounds us. And of course, he is not the only one. I mean, that's a topic. The entire research on phenomenology is focused on this. But Lacan has a very nice expression for this intertwinement between politics and the individual psyche, because he says in the famous quote, "The unconscious is out there." Excuse me. So he says the unconscious is out there, and with this proposition, he tries to get rid of a misunderstanding that we have from the unconscious. Sometimes we understand or we interpret the unconscious as some kind of inner psychological cellar or basement where we have our cadavers, the dead bodies, our imaginations, suppressed desires and aggressions, and so on. And Lacan breaks with this image. He says rather that the unconscious is a door not to our cellar, but to the big, what he calls the big other, to the superstructure of our social life, of our parents, of the institutions that surrounding us. And I think this is a nice entrance to understand what this proposition says. The unconscious is out there because now the unconscious is also representative of what Lacan calls in another context the big other, so that's language, society, enigmatic calls, and we are always in this structure of interpolation of what society wants from us, and this is something that gives my concept of excessive subjectivity an important inner psychological framework, of course. Because I want to understand what happens when subjects act out against their fellow human beings and try to reframe their desires. Though Lacan tells us, well, our desires are always interlinked with the desires of the others. But So in that sense, he follows interpretations from Louis Althusser on interpolation, because, I mean, in that sense, Lacan is not saying something new. But on the other hand, and against Althusser, says, well, of course, we are a subject, by definition, interpolated subjects. We have to obey to the law and we have to accept it freely. But on the other hand, or beyond going beyond Althusser, Lacan also says, well, the subject is always more than what the interpolation was. So there's always a missing link in the interpolation. And that is something that Althusser did not focus on. But for me, of course, this is essential, because it gives me a tool to interpret what excessive subjectivity is all about. It is part of an interpolated structure through the social framework that gives us certainty for our everyday life. On the other hand, Lacan shows us that interpolations have always an enigmatic remnant, something where the call of the big other or the call of society always misses us, or we misinterpret the call, and so we don't devolve into the big other like water and water. There's always a missing encounter. And in that sense, this, of course, is for me important to get something out of this missing encounter as the source where also then finally the excessive subject finds a free space to disconnect himself or herself from what society defines as reality.
Let's turn to Lacan's understanding of the subject. One of the themes you pick up is Lacan's adoption of Freud's Nebenmensch, or fellow human being, although this isn't to be understood in the typical way we understand a friend sitting beside us. Instead, it's a sort of alterity within us that helps constitute us in our reality. So can you unpack what Lacan is getting at here?
Well, Lacan takes the concept of the Nebenmensch from a famous text from Freud, early text, The Project for Scientific Psychology. But it's bizarre, Freud only mentions very briefly this context or this concept Nebenmensch, and then Lacan makes something with it. So in Lacan, one could say that the Nebenmensch is mentioned at first as some kind of source of alterity for the newborn child. And Lacan develops then this concept further, underlying how, through this kind of enigmatic encounter with the fellow human being, the subject somehow is the subject's life is conditioned through this enigma. So, to give an example, one could say that the Nebenmensch, in general, let's say it's first the parents, but Freud says, well, as I said, Freud doesn't say a lot, but Freud nevertheless mentions the parents, but experience in a different kind, for example, the mother crying. So there's something that the toddler or the child is irritated in the parents. Okay, but where do we go with this? I think what this brings to is that it's not that the parents exclusively open the world to the child in what, for example, many philosophers, but also Donald Davidson calls triangulation. So the child learns concepts and words and so is integrated into the social world. For Freud and Lacan, there's not so much the interest how the child is introduced into the world of rationality, of social order, but how the subject or the child is introduced via the enigma of an other. The enigma that has an effect on the child's desire, because the child wants to know what the other wants from him, or what's the desire what does the other see in him or her. So, and this is also, I mean, this is a big topic in Lacan's theory, because he says that the unconscious of the child develops always in relation to the unconscious of the parents. So the parents may not know themselves what kind of enigmatic message they are transmitting to their children, because they might not even know on what kind of fuel of desire they have been living their life with regard to their parents. But this is, for Lacan, this is essential. So the Nebenmensch somehow is the source of an enigma, and this enigma is important.
the way we relate to our desires, or we and in the way we relate or interpret what we perceive as the desire of the other that wants something from us. But it just underlines that that there is more in the subject than only rationality or understanding concept or giving and asking for reasons or knowing how to play the field of language. The subject is more than rationality. It's confronted with an enigma, and it somehow has to deal with this enigma. And this enigma might be very positive, but it might also be disastrous in a way if the subject cannot liberate itself from something that it never understood from the start.
Another key theme for Lacan is interpolation, which gets developed a lot in his essay in the Acri, The Subversion of the Subject in the Dialectic of Desire, where a subject emerges as a response to a particular sort of address and finds itself embedded within a chain of signifiers, albeit always with a certain stain of traumatic irrationality. So can you unpack this dynamic of interpolation for us?
Well, Lacan develops this concept of interpolation in the so-called text that he calls the subversion of the subject that you mentioned. I explain what happens in these interpolations to my students with an anecdote that a comrade of mine, a fellow Jesuit, told me once, and I think this is very insightful, because he told me that during weeks of prayer, when he was making his spiritual exercises, he remembered one day a sentence from his father. And what his father said was, and I quote, "I only respect the Jesuits." When I tell this to my students, there's always a laugh. Because on the one hand, you could say, well, it's totally unimportant what the sentence means to the father. Again, the quote, "I only respect Jesuits." But it was obviously not unimportant for this Jesuit, for the son who has become a Jesuit and remembers now the sentence during his spiritual exercises. And what is so interesting, at least for this subject, I would say, is that he could ask himself, well, was my whole life story built on a missed or misinterpreted message? Have I become a Jesuit because, in that sense, I wanted to gain respect from my father? Because it is, of course, absurd to remember situations like this. Because you could really ask yourself, well, what's the message? What have I? And in that sense, we are back to the enigma. What did I interpret? What did I hear? What was the message sent? And maybe the father wanted to express a totally different or contingent idea, but not in that sense. Animate the individual to become a respectful Jesuit, for example. But another, and that sense, Lacan also refers in this text to the quote "Que voy," often very famous in Lacanian literature. He takes this from a novel from Jacques Cazot from the 18th century. But I give you a last example that I also give my students time and again. Think of, because we are still asking what kind of traumatic irrationality can be in interpolation. And an example that I give, for example, think of Prince William, Duke of Cambridge. I mean, we know him, the son of Diane. He obviously stands in the call of the House of Windsor. And this call is something Prince William has to subjectivize himself to. Because, well, the House of Windsor does not want Prince William to play the role of a prince, so to act like an actor, but the House of Windsor has to get into the unconscious of Prince William because it wants that Prince William wants to be Prince William by himself. But again, and in that sense, you have somehow the big other, it's very stereotypically speaking, the big hours, the House of Windsor, you have this toddler, this newborn child, Prince William, and then you have the whole story of interpolation. But again, you could say, well, there is, of course, also an enigma in this kind of call. We would say, well, it's absolutely nice to be Prince William, Duke of Cambridge. But why? Why should we accept it? I could imagine that Prince William himself asks himself time and again, why do I have to to listen to this call. And I think these two examples might explain what interpolation is about, and how there's always an enigmatic remnant that throws the subject back on herself to question and maybe to relocate herself with regard to this call. And the call could also be by the entire society, and in that sense, also refer back to herself or himself and question the entire call.
Lacan saw subjects as functioning within various types of discourse, but the one you focus in on is the discourse of the hysteric, which not only plays a large role in his own therapeutic practice, but has larger ethical and political implications, as it has a very destabilizing or potentially liberating or emancipatory function. So can you unpack Lacanian hysteria for us and the role it might play for an ethical or excessive act?
Mm-hmm. Well, Lacan distinguishes four discourses. He calls them the discourse of the master, the university, the hysteric, and the analyst. And I have friends of mine who question the entire concept. But I don't want to explain them too deep. The basic, in that sense, I want to immediately focus on the discourse of the hysteric, because again, we can explain this discourse of the hysteric with regard to Antigone. Because what defines the hysteric by Lacan is that the subject, as the hysteric, questions time and again the totality of knowledge as represented by, for example, the polis or the political order, and the subject is surrounded by. So it's the world of norms and so on. So the hysteric is defined as the subject who always looks or sees or is affected by a lack in being. By a lack in the totality of knowledge, and this therefore question time and again the factual knowledge, and I refer to Antigone because of course she questions the authority of Creon, of the polis, and says, well, there's something missing. Lacan calls this object of missing object petit a, object small a, and he defines it as the conditions of our being to desire continuously, because we can never get to this object. But nevertheless, the hysteric object is in a way obsessed with the lack of knowledge. And that's also a little anecdote. That's why Lacan calls Hegel the most sublime hysteric, because when you read the phenomenology, you see that spirit as depicted by Hegel is this structure that is always missing itself and is always fascinated or always re-energized by getting back to, well, what's now missing and how can we go beyond what is missing? Maybe to loosen up a little bit the debate, an example of my personal life. I live in a Jesuit community in an apartment and time again, I have some arguments with a friend of mine who lives in this apartment also, because he reads every day the most important newspapers in Germany. They are called Süddeutsche Zeitung and Frankfurter Zeitung. And when he reads these papers, then I would say a little bit polemically, he repeats all the opinions that he just read about. So he absorbs, also polemically speaking, somehow the opinion of the big other as from one to one. Is he in the position of the hysteric? Of course he is not, because for him there's never somehow a doubt on the side of the big other. He takes it more or less at face value. And when we have the debate, or when I question this in that sense, I am the hysteric, because I always see somehow the lack of what's presenting me in national media. And I think this might explain what hysteric subjectivity is about, that you can even be neurotic in always seeing the missing link, while it might be more easily or more desirable to relax and accept what is presented to you as that what is factual.
You turn to Lacan's idea of traversing the fantasy, originally a therapeutic term that indicates a rather intense reorientation at the level of subjectivity, you then develop it as a way of understanding a variety of historical and political events or temporal ruptures. So can you unpack this traversal and how it gives us a way of understanding major shifts in history?
Right. Well, as I said, when we are interpolated by whatever the symbolic order, the law, the institutions, we are, and we become subjects, we are always subject in a phantasmatic framework. There are fantasies surrounding us. For example, I have a fantasy about myself, Dominik Finkelde. I'm a professor. There's somehow a phantasmatic framework regarding this. I'm a Jesuit. I'm a German. So I have all these layers of my identity as a social being, and these layers have phantasmatic structures. Because there's always a fantasy incorporated in these layers. For example, when I celebrate Mass as I'm a priest, there's of course an entire fantasy framework that gives me this authority to do these things. So I'm not only acting as if I were a priest. No, I'm taking in the fantasy that I am the priest that I am, or that I'm the professor that I am, or that I'm the doctor that I am, or the judge, or whatever. And that's important because our roles, this is what Hegel would call our second nature. So the social roles that are put on top on our biological natures, and the biological natures are our material bodies, our animal bodies. But our second nature is put on top and intertwined with these biological bodies, but they are maintained also by fantasy. Now, what traversing the fantasy is, at least that's what I understand. I'm not sure if that's all what can be said, but what for Lacan, traversing the fantasy is that it can happen that you have the impression that the phantasmatic framework you're in is not that you can fill. And then it might be very difficult for you to get rid of this phantasmatic framework because it doesn't only, well, you're not only getting money through being a professor or a doctor or a judge, but you also enjoy the phantasmatic framework of being this judge. So yeah, I'm not acting as a judge or as a doctor. I am this doctor, and this gives me enjoyment, a political enjoyment, because I have a force. I can speak in the name of the law of the people. So I understand that Lacan says, well, it might be absolutely difficult to get out of these second natures. And again, let's refer to Edward Snowden as an example, because I refer to Snowden time and again because I've written an article exactly on him, on how he can be interpreted as an excessive subject. We could say that he worked for the NSA and was also a part of a phantasmatic framework of what it means to work for such an important state agency. And now we know that he acted out against this entitlement, but he remained alone in doing so. And I would say that he traversed in that sense a fantasy. He traversed a fantasy that was, for example, at least for his colleagues, at least nevertheless very important. And as I said, it's not as easy that we can take our second nature and exchange it with another, because it is intertwined with our biological bodies. So traversing the fantasy is reinstating the framework of my subjectivity. But it's not that I can change it like I can change a jacket, a blue jacket to a white jacket. It's more than that. It's a paradoxical situation because I have to liberate myself without knowing where I'm going to. And I think that this is what traversing fantasy is all about. So reinscribing myself in a fantasy that is not yet proven.
To close off our discussion with Lacan, you turn to Kierkegaard, interestingly enough, as well as Zizek, and your understanding of discipleship as a response to a particular sort of calling. So to take us through to the end of the text, how does excessive subjectivity function in relation to a call coming from a particular sort of authority?
Well, Kierkegaard has written a very beautiful text, and I can recommend everybody to read it. It's called On the Difference Between a Genius and an Apostle.
And it was Žižek who interpreted this text brilliantly because he linked it with Althusser's theory of interpolation. I think, so what's all about? I think that's what I'm trying to get now. First of all, Kierkegaard is interested in the difference of the authority of a genius and an apostle. That's the title. And he says that what he calls a genius has a message that can be understood or transmitted to the disciples of the genius, and it can be understood conceptually. And now he makes the difference to the apostle because he says, well, the apostle has also a message like the genius, but what the apostle has to say cannot be absorbed and understood. One could make the difference or explain the difference in the vocabulary of analytic philosopher. And one could say, well, the genius speaks in propositions that have a truth value, and the apostle speaks in propositions that have not a truth value, but these propositions nevertheless have a message. So now everybody would say, well, it makes sense to follow the genius because his message can be understood, but that's not the point of Kierkegaard. The point of Kierkegaard is to say the message of the apostle will have a bigger effect because the message is incommensurable. It's incommensurable. It is it has an effect on the apostles, but they cannot absorb it. They cannot absorb the message in the immanence of their world experience. And another aspect is that I only understand, and this is also what Žižek focuses on brilliantly in his interpretation of this Kierkegaard text, that I only understand the message of the apostle when I leap into the horizons of what he is talking, how to explain it. When I leap with an act of faith into the position from which the message is articulated. This does not mean I can reduce the message of the apostle to a list of propositions. The point is rather that I can only understand the message from the horizon that the apostle himself opens up, the hermeneutical horizons of understanding. In that sense, we need this kind of leap of faith as the precondition of deciphering what the message. Can I repeat this?
Yeah, of course. Steven? I thought you were done. Go ahead. Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
So the leap of faith is the precondition of deciphering the message of the apostle. And again, this brings us to excessive subjectivity because the excessive subjects cannot make us understand why we have to follow them. We have to jump into the hermeneutical horizon they open up.
As a final question to wrap this all up, you've given us a theory of subjectivity that can get enmeshed or caught in a particular set of morals, values, or ideological trappings. But you've also argued that the converse is that we are always in some finite way capable of breaking out and beyond our immediate ethical horizons. Given everything you've just developed for us, how would you encourage listeners to go forward and think more critically about their place in a current political moment and how they might in some finite way stretch beyond it?
Thanks. At first, one has to accept that we as subject are always inclined to be submissive to obedience and to the society and to the law. That's our preconditions. And it would cause too much mental stress to question time and again the normative framework we are confronted with. Nevertheless, I think it is important to reflect on the fact that normally we are somehow always a step ahead of our obedience, because we take the social reality as a firm ground of what is granted the status of facts. And what the book tries to show is that we can disrupt or interrupt this first step into obedience to the law, and in that sense liberate ourselves from this dependence of what is presented to us as factual. And I think excessive subjectivity
can be a source to interpret what we mean to liberate us ourselves from this interpolation.
All right, that brings us kind of through the whole text. So as a final question, what, if anything, are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on a book where I try to bring the certain philosophers of what is called today materialism, materialist dialectics, in the dialogue with philosophers of the analytic tradition, especially with philosophers like Donald Davidson and John McDowell, because I think there's still need to relate these very radical philosophers with other traditions of philosophy. And that's what I'm trying to focus on, especially in the context of the understanding of conceptual schemes and if there is some kind of lack of being or a gap of being. Because analytic philosophers, or the ones I'm presenting, would say, no, there is no gap in being. And the philosophers that I'm interested in, like Zizek and Badiou, the time and again focus on this lack of being, and that's what I'm working on, to get this conceptually right, how these different schools differentiate themselves.
Sounds very fascinating. So Dominik Finkeld, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for the interview.